Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers, developers, and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, who gives you innovation training your customers will love you for. Get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, everyone. This is Chad. I am in Peoria, Illinois, in a gorgeous old historic house, which we'll hear more about in a moment. This happens to be the headquarters of Caterpillar. Caterpillar is the world's largest manufacturer of construction and mining equipment, diesel and natural gas engines, industrial gas turbines, and diesel electric locomotives. If you don't know, they make really big things, and innovation has been important to their 90-year history. However, we know being an innovator is not all roses. At times, you feel like a square peg in a round hole. This is especially true of serial innovators, a term popularized by the book of the same name, written by Abby Griffin and two of her co-authors. A serial innovator is often on the cutting edge, if not the bleeding edge, in a mature organization. They are the problem solvers that substantially contribute to the company's financial value. And thankfully, I just found such a serial innovator at Caterpillar, Steve Pierres. Steve, thanks so much for being with me.
Thanks.
And we're sitting in the dining room of your home. Describe this just briefly, because this is a beautiful setting in a very old historic part of the town.
Sure. It's an old house owned by an insurance executive built in 1892. Much of the woodwork is all original, not painted. The original chandeliers, original leaded glass, and just beautifully, held together.
It's gorgeous. Yeah, the wood paneling all over and the woodwork, the doors. It's gorgeous.
And with three boys and a little girl, we haven't broke anything. And so historically, it's still pretty accurate.
That's doing pretty well. I can't claim the same. I think I was maybe five when I broke the leaded glass in my parents' china cabinet. Mm-hmm. That's why it's plexiglass to this day still. But thanks again for talking to us about innovation. How long have you been with Caterpillar?
I've been at CAT for a little over 26 years.
That's a good amount of time. What kind of roles have you been in?
Everything from manufacturing processing on a shop floor, doing failure analysis, pure engineering in actual clutches and brakes and mechanical things. On the software side, on doing diagnostics and case-based reasoning, and then jumped into Six Sigma, Black Belt, Dometi, DeMake, Lean, CPI, and then got into our strategic consulting group, and then into product development and product strategy.
Okay, a lot of really good background. It looks like the people that are driving product development and innovation at Caterpillar primarily have an engineering background. Is that the case? And that sounds like it fits with yours.
Exactly. Caterpillar, being a very product-centric company, really is engineering-driven, especially on the product side.
Mm-hmm. Good. When we talked a little bit about setting this interview, I mentioned this term, serial innovator, because as you were describing your experience, it seemed to really fit. And you shared that you identified with that term. When did you figure out you were a serial innovator?
I always knew I was different. I just thought differently than most people. I questioned everything. I really didn't care who was there. I just said what I felt. And we did a benchmarking trip with ExxonMobil. And one of their lead scientists, we told them about CAT, and they were telling us about their innovation journey. And he brought up the term serial innovator, and he had a slide with 10 different characteristics. And as they were reading through, my boss, the vice president that was traveling with us, and a director in our R&D just kept looking over at me like, that's him. And, I went from the ugly duckling to a not quite so ugly duckling that day.
At least they had a label about that.
Exactly.
They knew how to think about you.
Yes.
Yeah. It's amazing how attaching a label to something gives it more importance at times.
It really does. Mm-hmm. Surprisingly.
Mm-hmm. Very good. So let's talk about what it's like to be a serial innovator. I described earlier that, you know, round peg, square hole, or vice versa situation. What's that been like for you? How does that feel?
Well, at times it's very uncomfortable. I've gotten to the point of almost being fired multiple times where I just stick with the position, knowing it's the right thing, and not backing down. And so at times it's very confrontational, but it's constructive, and it's never done maliciously. It's just done for the betterment of our customer and doing the right thing for our customer.
Mm-hmm. Did you know from the beginning of your career that you looked at situations differently, maybe more holistically than other people you worked with? Or did it evolve over time?
No, I definitely, throughout my career, ever since day one, I did things differently, you know, adding a synthetic quench to water and found that it broke down the water vapor blanket. And nobody ever thought of doing it that way before. Hmm. So I went and changed the entire procedure. I was not in a position as being a new engineer to go and change a corporate procedure, but I did it anyway. And so my dad was also an engineer, and so he always had us questioning, and whenever we drove, we'd stop at a factory and take a tour. It didn't matter if it was making cookies or machines. He always felt you could learn something by observing something different and associating it to your problems at hand.
Yeah, I love doing the same thing when I travel with my family, taking factory tours, and and when we're at home, we watch the How's It Made videos.
Exactly. My daughter and I do that. We'll go on demand and just watch 8-10 in a row.
Yep, my kids love those. They're very helpful. So being a serial innovator is not without its hardships, because you are facing these situations which are confrontational for the organization. In my case, my first 10 years or so of my career, I was with a company that we did prototyping all the time. And I thought everyone created products. I thought everyone was wired this way. It was only later that I figured out people don't. And you run into that confrontation with other functions, which they're trying to do what they need to do, right? Which is keep operations going. So do you have an example of a conflict you encountered that might have led to one of those almost firings?
My innovation, because I went from processing, so I innovated on process. Mm-hmm. In the case of changing a heat treatment to quench operation, Caterpillar's known for our heat treatment, and you know, you just don't do those type of things. I got myself in a lot of trouble for that. To product where I use microalloy and replaced a nitriding steel. Innovation, it's just looking at things differently. Mm-hmm. And bringing all your experiences to bear, which tests the traditional wisdom. And any time you push on traditional wisdom, when somebody's a tech steward and you call their baby ugly and want to do things completely differently, there's an immediate pushback, because normally these are very intelligent people who got to where they were by being the absolute best at what they're doing. Mm-hmm. But science and different things move on, and you can't just keep solving the question with the same answers right. You did 10 years ago. And that constant push, it's more of an irritant to them. And, you know, it's funny because occasionally it's like I introduce myself and I hear, oh, I've heard of you.
They know you're coming.
Exactly. It's not like, oh, nice to meet you. It's I've heard of you. Yeah. And or your reputation.
Which has
procedure.
That connotation of, oh, the troublemaker.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. And it's tough. I think some of the everyday innovators who are listening, certainly feel this pain because a lot of us are wired a little differently. Mm-hmm. And we don't mean to say someone's, you know, the existing way of doing something is bad.
Right.
And don't even try to come off that way, hopefully. But we're just looking at it. Can we make this better?
Right.
And it's this notion of continuous improvement.
And it's even more than continuous improvement because the incumbent people do an incredible job at continuous improvement, incremental change. Hmm. When I go into something and I innovate, I look for something significantly better. And that's what makes people so defensive. It's like, no, you can't do that. You can't do it. And Peter Diamandis, one of his quotes is, everything is that's a wild idea until the night before it actually gets done.
Right. Right.
And so it's the pushing things to try to look at things completely different to come up with a different answer. We need continuous improvement. If you look at Caterpillar, our products every generation get better and better mm-hmm. from all different angles, which produces a significantly differentiated product. Mm-hmm. But we were the first ones to put a track on a machine 90 years ago. You look at the track, it's still relatively the same. Mm-hmm. We were the first one to put a diesel engine into construction equipment. There's still a diesel engine 65 years later. What is going... We disrupted the traditional way of thinking. Are we going to disrupt ourselves? Are Right. we going to take that next giant step and throw away what got us to where we were at?
Right. Yeah, or someone else going to come along and do
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
If you don't do it yourself.
Exactly.
Which is the reason why we need serial innovators, mm-hmm. right? Looking at the new ways of doing things. Some time ago, I saw the phrase, innovation is in a new way. And I always think back to that if you're not doing something in a new way, you're not really innovating.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Oftentimes, people are worried about their good ideas being stolen. If it's really a good idea, you have to shove it down people's throats to get them to agree.
Larry Keeley wrote a book, The 10 Types of Innovation. Mm-hmm. And Caterpillar is very product-focused. And though that's only two types, product and product system. Mm-hmm. But there's the whole value chain that can be innovated on. And if you look at what's happening with the major disruptions with the Ubers and Airbnbs, mm-hmm. they're not changing a hotel room. You know, a room's still a room, a bed's still a bed. What they're doing, though, is they're creating a new business model. Their network is the individuals who have an extra bedroom. Their customer experience is one of a one-on-one relationship as opposed to a corporate customer relationship. And so they're innovating on more than just the typical two types of innovation. Right. And that's truly where the disruption comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And so you might have the best darn bulldozer, but, you know, quite frankly, if you don't have some of the other stuff, it's just not compelling enough for somebody to change from one brand to another.
Right. Sure. Yeah. Innovating the business model.
Exactly.
Innovating the customer experience.
Yes.
The example of EMI, too, is did GE change how they sell jet engines?
Exactly. And, power by the hour.
Yeah, that's it. And so they provide all the maintenance, and it's a service contract.
Exactly.
And so new business model.
New business model, totally. And they've innovated new processes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they get tremendous amounts of data. As the jet's flying through the air, they're doing analytics on that engine as it's flying through. They know the condition. They know to send service people there before it breaks because they have enough data and analytics to say, we've got to take care of this.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, good example. So at Caterpillar, there's a new innovation group, new in the last month or two?
Yes.
Is that correct? How did that come about?
It's been kind of this groundswell over the last 3 years, a recognition of the fact that our world is changing. Mm-hmm. And you see the hints all over the place. And our vice president, Greg Folley, as he was the vice president for the Reman and Components division, he was very open to innovation and allowed me to, quote unquote, play and try some pretty cool things that I can't tell you about. Some successful, some not so successful. And as he says, it's one thing to fail, but don't fail spectacularly, you know.
But they're learning experiences.
Exactly. And that's what they are. They're learning. And he was viewed, because of his championing and changing of the culture of failure is bad, to let's experiment, let's try, do your standard work perfectly. But when it comes time to trying something new, do it safely, do it small, off to the side. And other groups were coming to us, asking us how we did it, and we would help other groups. And as the corporation really over last year started fully embracing, we have to change, said it's significant enough that we have to create a whole new division called Data and Innovation, or Analytics and Innovation.
It seems to be a core theme, as I went to the Caterpillar website and got a sense of how Caterpillar communicates their brand these days, that innovation shows up repeatedly. And so it seems like they're really delivering on this theme by creating this group.
And exactly. And Caterpillar, throughout our 90-year history, has innovated time and time again and have created, but it was more random as opposed to being intentional. Now we're saying the world, it's accelerating. The exponential technologies are accelerating such that random occurrences of innovation, which were good 20, 30, 40 years ago, aren't good enough now. You have to keep the knife sharp. You've got to just keep questioning everything you do and trying to improve it.
Yeah, and accepting the failures as learning experiences. Just don't fail spectacularly. So I have an interview coming up with the director of that new innovation group, so I'll save the questions for him on how that really came about and characteristics of that group. As a serial innovator, you highlighted or really mentioned a couple examples along the way. I wonder if there's an example we can dig into more of, you know, a problem that was existing. You looked at it differently, and how that came about, resulting in a new process, a new product, a new business model, whatever that innovation was.
Okay. Back in the late 80s, early 90s, I was reading a lot about artificial intelligence. And it was, you know, the hype curve. It was big on the hype. At the same time, I was doing failure analysis for our undercarriage components, the track, more or less, track and gears. And Caterpillar has recognized leaders who know more about tracks and undercarriage failures, known throughout the industry as being the best in the world. Names like John St. John and Bob Beneke and some of the other just, you know, gods of metallurgy, so to speak, at Caterpillar. And so I met a guy who
with a PC at the time, did touchscreens. And so when we had a part that failed, we submitted to the MATLAB with a list of tests that we wanted done, hardness, chem spectros, microstructures, and, you know, on and on of what you could ask for. And there's lists about 25 things. Mm-hmm. But we had a lab guy who said, you only submit a sample once. You better get everything you want or, you know, don't bother resubmitting it. So being a young engineer, you don't want to miss anything, so you check 25 different things. And what you do is you clog up the MATLAB. Things, because you run so many tests that aren't needed, because you're afraid, and the costs are astronomical as you're doing all these tests and clogging up and they're adding more people. I said, there's got to be a better way. And I could take this part, hand it to the expert, and he'd look at it and say, yeah, that's spalling. If you just check the hardness on the rail right here, you'll probably find that the temper, it didn't go down below Rockwell C50. It was probably around 53, 54 by the looks of the size of it.
Okay, and I'm not a materials guy, so I have no idea.
So that sounds
important.
So anyway, he was able to tell me exactly why it failed, dead nuts. And I said, you know what? And at the time when I hired him 26 years ago, he was old. And, you know, he wasn't getting any younger. So I was learning about artificial intelligence, and I wanted to capture his knowledge. And to do that, so I wanted to take a component, take all the common failures, and to write a list of tests to say, okay, if you have something look like this, what is the common failure mode? And how would you confirm that? In the case of that I just said, you would do a hardness check. 20 minutes, a couple bucks, and you're done. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to confirm it, well, you'd have to do microstructure to look at the grains. You'd have to do chem spectro to make sure it wasn't out of spec, the steel hardness, and maybe 5 or 6 tests. Mm-hmm. Which would take more time, cost more money. And you'd say...
But still, it was not the list of the 20-something.
Exactly. So you find out the confirmation versus true root cause, and then you create a database. But what I concepted, and I found a guide that we, in 1990, had a touchscreen where you start off with a bulldozer, you touch the undercarriage, and it would break it out, and then you would touch... a component, you'd have all the different components, you'd touch the link, and up would pop the link.
So this is like peeling away the onion.
Exactly.
So you can move yourself into the part of the where the failure is.
And then, you know, there's three different parts on there, and then you touch it, and what were the top failure modes? And you'd look, does it look like any of these? If it is, you click on it, and you just confirm. And you save a lot of money. If it didn't look like one of those, here you describe what it is and then what would be the common test that you would go through looking for what the root cause was. And, you know, it was going to save, you know, at least 50 to 60% of the MATLAB's time and all that and really make a great change in capture the knowledge of these guys who forget more than I'd ever know. And then the recession in 91 hit. Funding was cut. And because that wasn't core, we continued to do things the way and
the more expensive way.
Exactly.
Yeah. Interesting example. And this is dating me too. In the mid-ish 80s, I was learning Lisp for our artificial intelligence programming. And I don't think anyone programs in Lisp anymore.
But the interesting thing with that is I'm doing the same things today using touch screens.
Right.
And it was an app that I created. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I was doing that in the early 1990s. and the computational capability wasn't there. The graphics weren't there. A lot of the pieces weren't there. Mm-hmm. But the concept was there of making something smart, putting it in the individual's hands to make the right decisions, right. Taking knowledge from an expert and democratizing it.
And I think we see that repeated many times. Mm-hmm. That there's an idea for an innovation inside a company, and it's just it's not the right timing.
Exactly.
Whether it be
timing
the political characteristics of the organization that say, no, you know, that's not us right now, or the market conditions or the technology. But over time, these things come back and around.
Exactly.
Which is a good reminder that companies, at least serial innovators inside companies, need to keep track of those ideas because they might see their future again.
But what's really interesting about that, and so I am a serial innovator, but I'm 12 to 18 months ahead. So I will develop something, mm-hmm. normally create a lot of turmoil, move on, then somebody moves in and the timing's right. Mm. So it's a catch-22. You're always moving on to your next idea,
right.
Never going backwards when the people who move in are two people after you, like you say, the time's right. So they walk in and your fingerprints are all over it, but you're never recognized for that contribution.
Yeah. In that sense, it can be, you know, rather frustrating.
It is. It's very frustrating.
Yeah. Because we don't get recognized for the contributions.
So, yep.
And I've seen that in other organizations with serial innovators. And it's tough. Your manager has to hopefully find ways to still encourage you and value you.
And you know, we're going through that now with rewards and recognition. Now that we're recognizing the innovator, chances are an idea you came up with will not bear fruit the same calendar year
right.
that our performance evaluations are.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't go back and say, oh, by the way, you know, last year I did this project and here's the results of it. It's like, well, that was last year. What did you do this year?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I did this. Show me the results. Well, it's not ready yet.
Yeah.
Well, show me your results. Very execution oriented. And that's the thing with product companies. Product companies tend to be execution-oriented, goal-related. What did you deliver? You delivered nothing? Sorry, you're an average employee. Well, look at what I did 2 years ago. Look at what it's doing to the bottom. Yeah, we missed that. But, you know, what did you do this year?
Right. Yeah.
So it's interesting.
Another element I've seen is companies that are very functionally siloed. Serial innovators tend to work across functions because we look at bigger pieces and we tend mm-hmm. to be more holistic. And we might identify a problem and help another function solve that. And there just isn't a mechanism in the company to get recognized or rewarded for making those contributions. I don't know if you've ran into that.
Not only have I run into it, but there's a lot of territorial
right.
problems that you get into. You know, when I'm not in the ground engaging, you know, the things that cut the ground on our buckets. I'm not in that group. But I came up with some biomimicry that reduced friction by 50% and lowered the penetration force by more than 40%.
Wow.
But once again, I'm not from that group. It was looked upon very negatively. Is what does this guy think he's doing? You know, he's not part of us. And I think I heard a statistic, correct me if I'm wrong, that 70% of all true innovation come from outside the field that has the problem.
Hmm.
So if you have, take photography, a chemical process turned into an electronic process.
Uh-huh.
So therefore, a chemist will never come up with that solution. It takes a whole different point of view to come up with the true innovation. And that's the paradox, is we ask the incumbents to innovate and they can't pull themselves out far enough to see it differently. So they do great with continuous innovation.
Right. Incremental.
Incremental and some spectacular incremental. Mm-hmm. Truly revolutionary? Maybe not. I don't think so.
Right. So, yeah, we often think of the lone innovator, you know, like Edison and the light bulb, and forget that there was an entire team around this person.
Yeah.
And it's those outside thoughts that usually lead to the breakthroughs. You need to step away from the domain.
I love, and we use the light bulb as, you know, the symbol for innovation. Mm-hmm. Well, that's been disrupted too.
Now right.
Tell me. Right. So we've got to come up with something new.
Something different. So a lot of everyday innovators are also wondering about how to make their organizations, their culture more innovation friendly. And we were talking earlier about meetings that you're doing, mm-hmm. weekly meetings. And I'd love for you to share that story about how that came about and what you're doing. And any tips you would have to offer listeners to do something similar?
Sure. So I went out to Singularity University.
So this is Ray Kurzweil's started.
Exactly.
It.
He's and now Peter the VP. Diamandis.
Yeah. So Ray's now the VP of engineering at Google.
Right.
We know him for creating the original synthesizer. Lots of patents this guy has.
Exactly.
So you went to Singular Institute.
I went through a two-day called Abundance 360, and then I went through the executive program. And Caterpillar invested a lot of money in me going to these. And, you know, we're always looking at how do we give back. And too often we internalize our education. I could have internalized that learning and made myself better. But I decided to say, and because you come back talking crazy, you know, the world is changing and blah, blah, blah. The
world suddenly got much larger.
Yeah, all of a sudden, you know, people look at me like my head's spinning. But there are four people who really liked what I was saying and were very interested. So I said, you know what, I'll take Diamandis's material. I sent him an email saying, Peter, I'm going to do these little things, probably last a couple, 3 weeks, don't know how long, but I'm going to take your material and I'm going to teach some people who are very interested. They would never attend your course. They're way too far down to ever, you know. But if you're going to make me go to a lawyer to get permission, I might as well drop right now. And I said, just sending me a yes to this email is good enough for me. I won't profit by it, and, you know, it'll stay within Caterpillar family. Sends me an email within 15 minutes saying, yeah, go ahead, use it. And that, to me, is a sign of somebody who is truly trying to make a difference and not just monetize his ideas. And so, you know, did it from 7 to 8 on Friday morning, called Friday Morning Coffee and Disruptive Technologies. And I did it because technically work starts around 8 o'clock. I prepared the material the night before, and it was just a WebEx and a phone conference. And they had some friends sitting, and they said, hey, can you invite these guys, and can you invite these? And every week, we would add 10, 15, 20 new people. And it was truly growing exponentially. So I ran out of material and started it again and started going and started finding some cool things being done at Caterpillar and started adding those and more people. And I would always, when somebody would say, hey, would you add, you know, my entire division? Because this is really good stuff. I'll say no. Send an email saying this is taking place. If they want to join because it's pure voluntary on their own time. This is not Caterpillar. This is just a method of learning. Then have them send me an email. Mm-hmm. And whoever is interested, they send me an email, and I add them to the invitation list. And, you know, we've had renowned authors like Larry Keeley, Dr. Dick Lee, Nathan Furr, and several other really great names. And it's truly amazing that passionate people, if you ask, they are more than happy to share their knowledge, especially an hour on a Friday morning when they know only people who want to be there are there. They're not there because they were told to be there. And it's kind of funny that at 6:54, I always take the video Happy by Pharrell. Mm-hmm. And I'll play it over the WebEx.
That's your bumper music.
And it just... Because, you know, it makes you feel good, and you should love what you do. You should be passionate about it. And watching these people dance, there's nothing but passion. And wouldn't it be great if everyone felt like that? Mm-hmm. And that's the way I feel going into work every day. I'm just happy to be there.
Yeah, a lot of people would love to feel that every day.
Exactly.
Right?
And Caterpillar has given me the freedom. It took 24 and a half years before they recognized that I can and I have contributed significantly over my entire career.
So the serial innovators listening should not give up.
And keep pushing. Just keep going. In fact, by nature, we are disagreeable. We will pick an unpopular position and stick with it because we know it's right to the point of being walked out the door. Mm-hmm. And either, you know, the corporation accepts you, or either they walk you out the door or you find another place.
Right.
And those are, or you get beaten down into submission.
Right. And, and just to wrap up, I'm going to break out a little bit those Friday morning coffee times you do.
Yeah.
So the steps here, you started with some of your own training, but now you're inviting external speakers, basically, and they do a managed, they facilitate a discussion using WebEx or GoToMeeting or something, right? And is it you just invite them to come speak? You tell them about your group?
Well, normally somehow I've met them at a conference or met them somewhere, tell them what we're doing. And we'll have 150 to 350, I think, Dr. Lee and Larry Keeley topped the 350, 400 people calling in. Because you're passionate about being there, and there's something inviting about when people make a choice with their time. Mm. And if, you know, you hear that there's 150 people from admins to vice presidents that call in.
So these are not just these so-called innovators.
Oh, no.
This is across the organization.
It's across every geographic area within CAT, every division. There's somebody that is calling into these coffee talks. We've got our dealers calling in. We've got suppliers calling in. We've got community people who have heard about it. And like I said, we talk about nothing confidential. We talk about the technology that's going to impact everyone's future. And that's why it's not just techies. It's everyone who, you know, just sees things are changing. And it's so bad. It's just so badly done from a professional standpoint that, you know, it's almost a joke, but yet, you know, people enjoy the content and you can't fake passion.
Right, right. I'm hesitant to ask this question because sometimes by thinking we need to manage something, we make that something no longer effective or efficient, right? But I'm curious if you have seen any ripple effects yet of doing these Friday morning meetings in terms of, you know, culture change and innovation, just how people are approaching problems. I don't know if you've...
We have seen, because what we try to do, we try to make it actionable. Mm-hmm. So if a speaker who's doing it on data analytics or data visualization, I'll say, okay, you heard this. If you've got a pile of data and you want it analyzed, Joe will analyze the first five people who send me an email. Hmm. Dr. Lee gave me 10 free Umidi courses, Udemy.
Yeah, yeah. So he does value innovation.
Exactly.
Value innovation course on Udemy.
So I try to make it actionable. We have went into areas based on, you know, somebody passionate about something that Caterpillar would have never been in before. Mm-hmm. We're seeing, you know, just people excited about innovation, and it's truly a grassroots swelling. We've got a great top-down push. Our CEO, Doug Oberhelman, really understands the value of innovation. We've got Greg Folley, who, you know, has supported and protected me for the last several years, pushing down. Mm-hmm. We also have the groundswell. There's hidden, pent-up innovation and creativity. We just have to allow it to happen and then figure out how to effectively allow people to contribute and where they see something being done rather than just throwing their ideas into, you know, an empty hole, that they see small experiments being done. Mm-hmm. To say, yeah, good idea, but it's time's not ready yet. And I love the one TED talk. It's yes or not yet. Mm. It's never no. It's not yet. One day it may be, but today it's not yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good perspective.
Yeah,
we never know when.
Exactly.
Good. So there's lots of ways that people can become good innovators. And Tom Kelly's book, The 10 Faces of Innovation, talks about the different roles, mm-hmm. right? I'm curious in your case how you would break it out. So obviously you have an engineering background, materials background, and I would think, you know, competent knowledge in those areas are just a prerequisite for the role you're in, right? So that's a given. You had to be a good engineer for what you're doing. But beyond that, what do you think has made you successful as an innovator?
I would definitely say my dad. Hmm. My dad was an engineer. He always questioned everything. He was always putzing around in the garage doing something. Never fixed anything in the house, but when it came to experimenting in the garage, he was always all over that. I mentioned that he would take us kids on tours, mm-hmm. To different facilities. Grew up in a die casting factory. He was an engineer. So from a greenfield, my bedroom window looked out onto a factory. I drove forklifts instead of mini bikes. And so I lived in Ireland and Canada. So I think a different cultural experience, mm-hmm. geographical, it just different experiences. And, you know, my wife and I were talking that we're truly in an exponential world. And it's exponential of experiences. Hmm. Before, when you grew up, you know, 40, 50 years ago, you might stay in that same small little town hearing only three television stations. But the exponential of experiences, now you're just, and almost to a fault, being inundated with 24-hour news feeds. 24-hour, you can consume as much experiences as you want to. And the brain is capable of absorbing even more. So the more you cram in there, the more it will associate. And the more ideas you come up with, mm-hmm. my wife says, Steve, living with you is exhausting. You just don't turn it off.
Yep.
So.
Yep. So a big influence just from your father. Maybe a little bit of DNA involved in there. And you said a key thing was identifying problems and asking questions.
And observing people and just looking at where they having problems. Just looking at their faces when they do something mm-hmm. and saying, is there an easier way of doing this? You know, should somebody throw a wrench across the room because they're frustrated because they keep hitting their knuckles on something? You know, is there a better way?
Yep.
And that customer empathy, my wife, and she picked it up from Doblin and them, that to be systemically, passionately curious about your customer, where you know more about that customer, and it's not just the functional needs, but the social and the emotional needs associated with what they do. Mm-hmm. And when you can truly empathize with the customer, then you will come up with delighters the customer didn't even know they needed.
Right. That's the other dimension of innovation, is that customer experience and improving that.
Yep.
So, and again, the iPod is probably the classic example that most of us had in our pockets at one time, and it was just on my smartphone, right?
Exactly.
So, as my listeners know, I always like to kind of wrap up interview time by asking for a favorite quote, innovation or success quote. Do you have one that you want to share with us?
Yeah, and it comes from my favorite video, which is Google X's Moonshot Thinking, mm-hmm. and where Astro Teller, there's actually three quotes, where he says, choose to be bothered. That something can't be done, because that gives you that potential energy that you need to just, if you're bothered by something, you're going to do something about it. Mm-hmm. Choose to be bothered. I love that quote. And then Megan makes some comments about, you know, once you find your passion, you're unstoppable. And then the third one is, our ambitions are a glass ceiling to what we can accomplish. Hmm. Because we can do so much more than we could ever even imagine. We just have to keep dreaming big. Mm-hmm. So that's my favorite video, and those three different snippets from towards the end is what I always go back to.
Good. And for anyone listening that wants to watch the video, what's the name of the video again?
It's Moonshot Thinking by Google X. If you Google Moonshot Thinking, it'll pop up.
We'll find it.
Yeah, it's well worth the 3 to 4 minutes.
Very good.
Yeah.
Any closing remarks just to wrap up with the product managers and innovators listening?
If you have somebody with ideas, encourage them. Don't, even if you know it's not a good idea, say, you know, I'm not seeing it right now, but let me think about it before I react. Before I tell you, let me have a day to think about it. And there's always something that can be cleaned out of somebody's observation. If somebody comes up with an idea, there's a reason. He or she might come to the wrong conclusion. Mm-hmm. on how to solve it, but what problem were they trying to solve? But if for product managers, be positive when somebody comes to you with ideas. And the experts normally tell you 100 ways you can't get something done. Be that one person that takes an idea and tells you how you can make it work, mm-hmm. as opposed to why it won't work.
Mm-hmm.
And that.
Yeah. And as you said before, maybe the response is not yet.
Exactly.
Right? Just to take it in still. Yeah. Good. Well, thanks for welcoming me to your home, and thanks for talking about innovation with Everyday Innovators.
Thank you for listening to Product Innovation Training Your Customers Will Love You For. To learn more, please check out the blog at theeverydayinnovator.com. Keep innovating.